In our second session regarding stocks, we're going to take a look at the various stock markets, also called the capital markets. And this used to be a pretty dull, relatively straightforward topic. Not anymore! It is morphing and transforming and mutating and changing at breakneck speed. So let's get started on slide number 11. There are two markets for stocks, folks. There is the primary market, and then there is the secondary market. Now, people don't actually use these terms very often, but that's what they're called. The primary market is the market in which new issues of securities are sold to the public. Most people know this as what is called IPO, the initial public offering, the first public sale of a company's stock. It's also called going public, taking the company public. Most retail investors, such as you and me, do not participate in the primary market, folks. My recommendation is that we really shouldn't. We'll discuss this as we go along, but for the vast majority of us investors, it's not our league. Doesn't mean you shouldn't, doesn't mean you won't, but it's just not something for us, as we'll see. The secondary market is the market in which securities are traded after they've been initially issued to the public. The vast majority of transactions every day take place in the secondary market. Now, slide number 12. Why should a company go public? In other words, why do corporations issue common stock? Why do they sell pieces of themselves? Well, for various reasons. To raise money, to start or expand a business. They've got a great idea for a product, but they need $100 million, and they don't have it lying around the house. To help pay for ongoing business expenses. This is the life support system for many of the biotech companies based here in San Diego. They need hundreds of millions of dollars to get a drug through the pipeline, and so from time to time they will go out and sell more of their stock to pay for the ongoing business expenses. And once a company just becomes large enough, it is simply expected that they will go public. It is a way to gain prestige and respect within the investment and industrial communities. And the people who take the company public are often richly rewarded. They often become multimillionaires overnight, or sometimes, in some cases, multibillionaires overnight. The gentleman who is the CEO of Facebook, right? He had a $1 billion tax bill the day that Facebook, exactly, that's how, you know, richly valued Facebook is. So these people are rewarded well. Now, remember, folks, in case your eyes are lighting up and your mouth is watering and you're thinking, I want to do that. I want to be an entrepreneur. For every one Facebook, there are a dozen or more MySpaces, Cape Pasta, whatever all the other ones are called. And simply once a business becomes large enough, it becomes very difficult to divvy up the spoils, so to speak, to break up the company without going public. If you were one of the people who started a large company such as GE or Coca-Cola or Walmart or Facebook or whatever, how would you sell your share of the business? You see, these companies are so large that it just becomes unwieldy for one group of people to own, usually the family, to own the company. But there are some large companies that have resisted the urge to go public, and you may have heard of some of them. One of the biggest is Mars. Mars? You know it as M&Ms, right? And Snickers. You can buy shares in Hershey, folks, but you can't buy shares in Mars because it is a private company. Indeed. And sometimes this, you know, works out fine, and sometimes it can get really sticky. For those of you who are big fans of In-N-Out Burger, and there are many, you might want to take a look at the history of this company and what happened when the original owners passed away and passed on the business to the family. There was a bit of a family feud about the direction of the company. Indeed. And so these things happen with public companies too, but it's just a lot harder when you have a private company. Slide number 13. Continuing, why should you go public? The corporation does not have to repay the money, unlike a bond where you make a loan, that's what a bond is, you have to pay the interest and the principal. The company, on the other hand, is under no obligation to repurchase the shares of the stock, and the shareholder may or may not be able to find someone who will purchase the shares from them in the secondary market, but assuming it's a bona fide company, that shouldn't be a problem. But now, once the company goes public, they have many rights and responsibilities that private companies do not need to worry about. They must file 10-Ks, annual reports. They must file 10-Qs, quarterly reports, with the Securities and Exchange Commission. They must have at least one public meeting annually where shareholders can come and air their grievances. Quite a little interesting story in the late 90s, Sempra, the parent company of San Diego Gas and Electric, made some serious boneheaded maneuvers, folks. And every year, the meeting would be in San Diego, and many people would show up and jump up and down and yell at the management for being boneheads. And one year, they decided, oh, we'll fix your little red wagon. They moved the meeting to London, one of the most expensive cities in the world. And I'm sure there were far fewer people jumping up and down telling them how boneheaded they were. But still, once you're a public corporation, you have serious rights and responsibilities that you must contend with. If you were to go to Mars and ask them, how much money did you make last year? How much cash do you have on hand? They'd look at you and say, who are you? Are you the IRS? We don't have to tell you anything. But if you go to Hershey, it's all there. It's all outlined in their annual and quarterly reports with all the financial statements that have to be done. Indeed. Now, Chapter 5 in the book goes into much detail about initial public offerings. Excuse me. If you take the Series 7, you're going, Series 7 stockbroker exam, it's called, is actually registered representative. If you want to become a stockbroker, a registered representative is the legal term, you really have to understand this process. And so all the information in Chapter 5 is what you need to learn, plus some more. But the truth is that initial public offerings do not usually live up to their expectations. The typical IPO loses 50% of its value in 1 year. Now, there are notable exceptions that do well, but 50% of their value in 1 year? Benjamin Graham, who was Warren Buffett's teacher, and we'll come back to him later on at various points throughout the semester, said that IPO stands for it's probably overpriced, or imaginary profits only. Exactly. So, as I said before, my personal belief is that for the vast majority of us, IPOs are something we should avoid. But if you want to get involved, good luck. Read Chapter 5 thoroughly. Find a good stockbroker who can help you get in on the ground floor and pray that it doesn't lose 50% of its value in 1 year. Slide number 14. Okay, let's get down to the brass tacks. Here are the secondary markets, the aftermarket. Markets in which securities are sold after they have been issued. Secondary markets provide liquidity, which is a fancy way of saying you can easily buy and sell your shares, easily transfer ownership of the securities, and an efficient, for the most part, mechanism for pricing and valuing securities. When people talk about the stock market, they are almost always referring to the secondary market. So when you hear stock market, you understand secondary market. This is the place that securities, stocks in this case, are bought and sold once the company has been issued to the public. There are two types of secondary markets on slide 15. The organized securities and exchanges and the over-the-counter market. Now, this slide should really just have a big X through it, because this is an outdated comparison. Due to technology advancements, mergers, acquisitions, the traditional differences between the two have been erased, and the changes are just getting started. You see, for hundreds of years, literally, the securities and exchanges were centralized institutions in which transactions were made in outstanding securities. And we had what was called a double auction, which is unfamiliar to most of us and a little bit confusing when you watch it. You're used to a single auction where there's a single seller and multiple bidders, multiple buyers. But in the double auction, at any one time, there are multiple buyers and multiple sellers, all yelling out their prices that they will buy or sell the security at. And to the casual observer, it looks like chaos. But once you're in the pits, you understand that it's basically just a big swap meet that people are buying and selling stocks. Well, these are gone, folks. I mean, there's still some human interaction, but for the most part, everything's electronic. The over-the-counter markets were widely scattered telecommunication networks through which transactions were made in outstanding securities and smaller initial public offerings. And when they said telecommunication network, they meant telecommunication network. Somebody in Minneapolis would call somebody else in Cleveland and say, "Hey, Fred, you got 100 shares of that butterfly.com? Yeah, I got them. How much you want for them? I'll sell them to you for 25. And then he'd slam the phone. You know, "Forget it. You're out of your mind." And then 10 minutes later, he'd call them up. "I'll give you 22 or 40. The other guy would slam the phone down. These people took lessons in how to be rude to one another. But that's all gone. It's all electronic. Both of these systems are now completely electronic. There are still a few human face-to-face interaction, but for the most part, that's all gone. Historically, on slide 16, in the organized exchanges, All trading was conducted on the exchange floor. Trading was conducted using a double auction. As we said, instead of the one seller, multiple buyers that you see in a state or a farm auction, there were multiple sellers, multiple buyers, all calling out prices and quantities for which they will buy or sell a certain security, in this case, stocks. But due to both technology and the sheer massive volume of shares trading, things have changed. Almost all the trading is now conducted electronically. Some large trades still involve human interaction, but they now consist of far, far less than 1% of the total number of trades. There's been talk of even closing the floor of the New York Stock Exchange, because if you go back and look 20, 30 years ago and you see the videos of it, there's people running around, pieces of paper all over the floor. Now, there's hardly anybody on the floor. And, yeah, it's just, I think they keep it open for the television. Yeah. And this is the big one, folks. Slide number 17, the New York Stock Exchange. The NYSC, some people call it the NYSE. Often called the big board. Traditionally, and we mean that word serious, traditionally, the big board, the New York Stock Exchange, was responsible for over 90% of the volume of transactions on exchanges. There were 1,900 companies as of January 2015 or so, about $20 trillion of market capitalization. And it's interesting, when you go to their website and go to other websites and try to find out how many companies there are and what's the market capitalization, the numbers vary. So you got to be careful. Of course, they change every day because companies are bankrupt and some come into existence. But what does market capitalization mean? Well, we'll discuss that in detail in a later presentation. We'll do some calculations. But that means how much the companies are worth. $20 trillion. That's a big number. A whole lot of zeros. In 1792... the New York Stock Exchange was established as a members-only entity when Wall Street really was a wall in Manhattan. Companies listed on the New York Stock Exchange must meet stringent requirements. These are the largest and traditionally most prestigious companies. Companies can be delisted. You might have heard of Kodak. Yes, Kodak, exactly. It was a huge company for decades because they sold everybody little yellow boxes of film. But then, how many people use film anymore? So when a company fails to meet these stringent requirements, they are kicked off the New York Stock Exchange, because this is where the best companies were. But not anymore. The New York Stock Exchange has some serious competition now. On slide 18, we see that there have been big changes at the NYSE, the New York Stock Exchange. In 2005, they purchased the Archipelago Electronic Exchange and the Pacific Regional Exchange. What are those? Hang on a minute. We'll see those in a few slides later on. They became a publicly traded corporation in March of 2006. Wait a minute. No more old boys club, private membership. Oh, by the way, the first woman was admitted in 1966, I think. The first person of color in 1992. They have phased out pretty much all that double auction face-to-face trading in favor of exclusively trading electronically. In 2011, Germany's stock market tried to purchase the New York Stock Exchange, Germany's Frankfurt Börse, I think that's how you say it, but was blocked by the European regulators. And then, on November 13, 2013, the New York Stock Exchange was acquired for the total sum of $11 billion by a 13-year-old derivatives trading firm from Atlanta, Georgia, called the Intercontinental Exchange. So the New York Stock Exchange is now owned by a company based in Atlanta. In 1992, on their 200th birthday, if you had told the folks at the New York Stock Exchange that the next 20 years would see far more changes than in their first 200 years, culminating with them being sold to a company that hadn't even been in existence until 2000, the year 2000, they would have thought you were quite insane. And yet, this is what the technology has done. Indeed. And here's a couple of links that describe the completion of the acquisition by Intercontinental Exchange, and a epitaph, so to speak, from The Economist, a very prestigious magazine. Slide number 19. Well, we really should put X's through these slides, shouldn't we, too? Because there are no more floor brokers. But house brokers were people who worked for certain individual companies, and they executed brokerage firms, and they executed orders on behalf of their firm's customers, or occasionally on behalf of the firm's own account. The company itself can buy and sell shares, the brokerage firm. The independent brokers, the $2 brokers, as they were called, would be running around and providing as-needed execution services to the house brokers, to member or non-member broker dealers. They were independent of any particular firm. Now, the floor brokers were very worried, and still are worried, that the aggressive moves by the New York Stock Exchange to all electronic trading meant the end of their way of life. And folks, the truth is, it's not really the end. It was just a big change from face-to-face interaction to sitting in front of a computer screen all day. Does this sound familiar? Here I am giving a presentation to a computer, and I have my nice little microphone here that I talk into, and there you are at some other time listening and watching to this presentation. Are we face to face? No, we're all electronic. Brave new world. Slide number 20, the specialist. Well, again, let's put another X through this guy because the specialist role is changing. On the New York Stock Exchange, the stock exchange specialists were members who specialized in making transactions in one or more stocks. The job of the specialist is to, and we should say was to, manage the auction process. They buy and sell stocks from their own inventory to provide a continuous, fair, and orderly market. The idea was if everybody disappeared, all the buyers disappeared, they were to step up to the plate and buy. If all the sellers disappeared, their job was to step up to the plate and sell. The role of the specialist is being squeezed out by technology and the tremendous volume of trading. They are becoming less and less involved in the typical trading day. And in 2009, they changed the name to designated market makers and supplementary liquidity providers. And what's a market maker? What's a liquidity provider? We will see that term market maker is used in the OTC and the other exchange, the other places that we buy and sell stocks. So hang on to that term. From time to time in the past, the specialists were either praised or maligned. Suffice to say that the specialists are trying to make a profit just like everyone else. While their goal may seem altruistic, buy when others are selling, sell when others are buying, they do their best to make sure that when the market receives benefits from their efforts, so do they. But as we said, they're disappearing because of technology. Slide 21. For decades, there was the New York Stock Exchange and then its little kid brother, and they weren't related, but now they are, the American Stock Exchange, the Amex, the Curb? The Curb? Where did that name come from? Well, they started on the curb outside the New York Stock Exchange. They would look in the window and see what was going on, and then they would trade out on the curb. And so there's a little image of the curb brokers doing their job out there. It gets cold in New York in the winter, and it's hot in the summer. But it's now no longer called the Amex. It's called the New York Stock Exchange MKT. Or MKT? I don't know. I've never heard anybody... I don't know who made up the idea of calling it the MKT. And nobody told us brokers. I mean, I asked my boss. I saw it quite by accident. What happened to the American Exchange? What's this New York Stock Exchange micket? And I called my boss and said, did you hear about the Amex changing their names? He goes, no. This would have been a monumental event 30 years ago. Now it's something that nobody even notices. It's much smaller than the New York Stock Exchange, only about 3% of the volume of all exchanges. And about a little over 20 years ago, they saw the handwriting on the wall. They started concentrating on securities other than stocks over 20 years ago. Remember the ETFs that we described in Chapter 4, the exchange-traded funds? Well, they were first introduced on the Amex, on the American Exchange, which is now called the New York Stock Exchange MiCA. By the way, for decades, they got their own building after a while. They weren't on the curb forever. They had their own building down the street. Now they closed that. They're with the New York Stock Exchange. Because what happened is the NASDAQ, which we'll discuss in a few slides, purchased the American Exchange in 1998, but then kicked them out the door in 2004. And then in 2008, the New York Stock Exchange bought them. I moved them down the street to the same building as the New York Stock Exchange, and their name was changed to New York Stock Exchange MiCA, or MKT, or probably they want you to say market, don't you think? I don't know. Call them up and ask them. I've never heard anybody use that term. Slide 22. Then, for decades, there were the regional stock exchanges, which were modeled after the New York Stock Exchange and the Amex, but they were only accounting for a total 4% of the exchange volume. Chicago, Philadelphia, Boston, Pacific, Boston, Denver, Cincinnati. They're all centralized locations except for the Pacific, which has two locations, one in San Francisco, one in L.A., figured that one out. And the Denver was the one that was, you know, the wrong place for you to be. When somebody said, oh, I bought this stock on the Denver Exchange, you just went, oh, boy. Many of the securities listed on the regional exchanges are also available on the New York Stock Exchange or the NASDAQ, which we'll take a look at. Traditionally, the regional exchanges were often places where undesirable or unethical issues were sold. But they have been trying to reinvigorate themselves. They've tried to diversify and differentiate themselves from the New York Stock Exchange and the NASDAQ in order to survive. For example, the Philadelphia Exchange has concentrated on semiconductors. So you'll hear people say, well, the Philadelphia Exchange says this about the semiconductors. What's going on with that industry? Plus, they have not been immune to the rush to consolidate. The New York Stock Exchange bought the Pacific Exchange. The NASDAQ bought the Philadelphia Exchange. You see what's happening? Yeah. Slide 23. Options and futures. Well, we said in Chapter 1 that options and futures are derivatives. We will discuss them later in detail. But they have their own exchanges. And these got their start, and it's still very large, in Chicago. But they're now traded on most of the major and regional exchanges, too. But the options exchange was the Chicago Board of Exchange, the CBOE, and the futures contracts that we'll discuss in detail later on are on the Chicago Board of Trade. And why Chicago? For historical reasons, because this was the location that many of the commodities that are tied to the futures contract. And what's he talking about? Well, pork bellies and beef and wheat and soybeans. They are not only Chicago, but they went through Chicago on their way to the rest of the world. I know it's hard to believe that Chicago is a major port, but that's what the St. Lawrence Seaway is for. Exactly. So the options and futures exchanges, they had their own exchanges. But as we said, they're all now bought and sold on all the other exchanges, too. Those were the exchanges, which we said were centralized locations, but not anymore. And now we'll take a look at the over-counter market, which used to be that widely scattered telecommunication network through which transactions of securities were made, people calling each other on the phone and yelling at one another, but now it's all electronic. These do not use the double auction system. They use a quote-based system, which we will discuss in just a moment. And there are three tiers. The first tier is the NASDAQ. Now, the NASDAQ does not want to be associated with the OTC anymore. If you say to one of the people at the NASDAQ, oh yeah, OTC, over-the-counter, you're one of the over-the-counter markets, they will bristle. No, we are the NASDAQ. They don't even want you to refer them to themselves as the National Association of Securities Dealers Automated Quotation System, because very few people knew that's what NASDAQ meant, and they've jettisoned the name. The other two major competitors, or players in the OTC market, were the bulletin board and the pink sheets. While the pink sheets now call themselves the OTC Markets Group, it appears, at least from their press releases, that they're trying to clean up their act. But, folks, stay away from these places. This is where the companies that aren't real companies, it's somebody's garage somewhere out in Iowa or Idaho or one of those places that starts with the letter I. And this is where the penny stocks that we will discuss later on are bought and sold. They are not real companies. They are shams. And you might have seen the Wolf of Wall Street or the Boiler Room. And these are the scams that are out there. And you may have gotten email messages from somebody you didn't know who they were, saying to buy this stock, it's selling for 3 cents and it's going to go up to 30 cents. This is the wrong side of the tracks, folks. This is the red light district, the bad side of town. And as we said, they seem to be trying to clean up their act, but they're all still out there, all those thousands of bogus companies. Now, there are a few that are trying to survive, but many of them are just shams, complete and utter shams. And we have a few links about penny stocks and a couple of articles for you to link at and look at. Stay away. Slide number 25. In the exchanges, we had the specialists and the brokers. But in the over-the-counter market, we have what are called dealers, also called market makers. Remember the term? The specialists are now being called market makers? Right, exactly. Because they're no longer specialists, they're basically dealers now. And dealers are traders. They're speculators who make markets by offering to buy and sell certain securities, in this case stocks, at stated prices. And they offer these buy and sell quotes from their own inventory of stocks. Whereas brokers simply serve as a go-between between buyers and sellers. Brokers don't keep an inventory. Well, some of the brokerage firms do, but the idea of a brokerage firm is, look, I'll go out and find a buyer for your shares. I'll go out and find a seller for the shares you want to buy. But not so for the dealers. The dealers make the market. They're the specialists. They own a certain number of shares of this stock, and they will buy and sell. Here are two terms you need to memorize. I know it's a little tricky. The ask price is the retail price. It's the price a dealer offers to sell a security. And the bid price is the wholesale price. That's the price the dealer offers to purchase a security. So you see, when you look on the internet or somebody tells you, oh, it's selling for, $3.87. Well, no, that's just the best price available. They're going to charge you more than $3.87 when you buy it, but then they're going to pay you less than $3.87 when you sell it back to them. Does this sound familiar? Hang on a minute. We're going to come back to it in a minute. And the difference between the bid and the ask prices is called the spread. Very important number. So the dealers, the market makers on the NASDAQ, on the bulletin boards, on the pink sheets, perform roughly the same role as the specialists on the New York Stock Exchange. In fact, the specialists are now being called market makers. Slide number 26. Unlike the brokers who charge a commission, dealers make money from the spread, from the difference of what they will buy it from you for and what they will sell it to you for. The difference between the bid price, the wholesale price, and the ask price. And one way to remember this is the old saying, if you have to ask how much it is, it's too expensive. And so the ask price is more expensive. I don't know if that helps. If it does, great. If not. And some of you travel down to TJ, Tijuana, often, might be cluing into this, folks, right? The Casas de Cambio in San Isidro and Tijuana, you don't see one price for what they will exchange dollars and pesos. You see two prices. You see a price for which they will buy your pesos and give you dollars, and which they will sell your, I'm sorry, did I say that right? Buy your pesos and give you dollars, and sell your dollars and give you pesos. So there is a presentation. And in the face-to-face class, we would switch to this, we jump to this presentation and go through it. But in the online class, it's a separate presentation where I go down there and I take some pictures of the Casas de Cambio. And you'll see that the prices are not the same, folks. There's prices all over the map. And this is what's going on in the marketplace at any one time. You see a single number, but that's not going on. There are dozens of numbers as different market makers, dealers, brokers, specialists are all trying to buy and sell for the benefit of their clients or for their own benefits. The dealers' markups and markdowns are not reported to the customers, whereas the brokers' commissions are reported. So how do you think the internet brokers make money on a $5 or $7 trade? We'll discuss this in detail in our next presentation. Slide 27. The National Association of Securities Dealers Automated Quotation System. Isn't that a great name? No, its name is gone, folks. They don't want you to even remember that name. They want you to know them as the NASDAQ. You see, the National Association of Securities Dealers was the non-governmental organization that used to be responsible for the self-regulation of registered representatives, which is the legal term for a stockbroker. They were sponsored by the Securities and Exchange Commission to make sure that the hanky-panky was kept to a bare minimum. But that organization, once they saw how popular the NASDAQ was, once the NASDAQ got huge, they gave up that duty, changed their name just to NASDAQ, and now a different organization called FINRA, Financial Industry Regulatory Authority, they are responsible for regulating the registered representatives. The NASDAQ created the first electronic communication systems back in 1971, when people used modems, I don't even know what a modem is, to go online. But now it is a huge entity that has roughly 2,800 stocks, and they used to be the arena for small companies to get started. Once they became large enough, the idea was they would move to the New York Stock Exchange. Well, since the 1980s, many prestigious companies, mostly tech, but not all tech, decided to stay on the NASDAQ rather than move to the New York Stock Exchange. So companies that you may have heard of, like Apple and Microsoft and Intel and Oracle, but also Costco and Starbucks, not just tech companies, decided to stay on the NASDAQ. We're very happy on the NASDAQ. Thank you very much, New York Stock Exchange. And in the 23rd floor, 48th floor, whatever floor the boardroom is in New York, there were two words that came out of the boardroom. The first one was, oh, exactly. Now it's a two-horse race, where before, the big board was the only game in town and everybody else were poor relations. The NASDAQ has given the New York Stock Exchange a serious run for their money. Slide 28. The NASDAQ has three tiers. The global select market, the creme de la creme. These are companies that would easily qualify for the New York Stock Exchange. Then the global market, which used to be called the national market. These are larger companies, but not as large as the global select. And the capital market, which used to be called the small cap market, is the third tier. In the 1990s, the NASDAQ began positioning themselves as the securities market of the future. You see, it was a dig at the New York Stock Exchange, because they were basically saying that the New York Stock Exchange is the securities market of the past. As it became apparent that the traditional face-to-face double auction model was not adequate to keep up with the massive increase of trading. The market capitalization, it means how big the companies are, on the NASDAQ is roughly $8 trillion. So it's still smaller than the New York Stock Exchange, but they have the distinction of having the world's largest company by market capitalization. Again, we'll discuss that in detail, how much the company is worth, and that's Apple, right? So a lot of that $8 trillion is one company. Slide number 29. There were alternative trading systems that started to crop up in the 1980s and 1990s. The third market was the over-the-counter transactions made in securities that were listed on the New York Stock Exchange, listed on the Amex, or one of the other organized exchanges. But this was designated, this was concentrated with institutional investors. It was dedicated to institutional investors who trade in large blocks of securities, stocks in our case. A mutual fund, they want to buy 100,000 shares. They don't want to buy 100 shares. They want to buy 500,000 shares. Or an insurance company or a pension plan. And so the idea was, we can reduce your cost by linking you up with other mutual fund companies, with other insurance companies, with other pension plans who want to buy. They wanted to do the opposite. I forget exactly what I said the first time, but it's one company wants to sell 100,000 shares, the other company wants to buy 100,000 shares. This will reduce their costs because we will find another entity who wants to do such large trades. They were still facilitated by a dealer, and one of the big ones in this market was called the Intermarket, which eventually became the NASDAQ. The NASDAQ bought them. You see, they're not stupid, right? And then the fourth market was taking it one step further. These were traditionally transactions made directly between large institutional buyers, entities such as mutual funds and pension plans with large blocks. But the idea was to bypass the dealers, just get rid of the market makers, the middleman. The middlemen, the middlewomen. They became known as ECNs, Electronic Communication Networks. And you could think of them like eBay. If you've ever bought and sold stuff on eBay, eBay just takes a percentage. They don't get involved. They just have other people buy and sell stuff. And one of the big ones here was the Archipelago, which eventually was bought by the New York Stock Exchange. Exactly. Another large alternative trading system is called BATS. Better Alternative Trading System, I think. I forget exactly what it stands for. But they have gotten fairly large, folks. I think they're about 10 or 11% of the current trading. Now, you have to know that the world is turning upside down. When a company based in a Kansas City strip mall, where a supermarket used to be, is now competing with Wall Street. Because that's where Bats is based. It's based in Kansas City in a place where used to be a, you know, Vons or whatever. That's how much the technology has disrupted their world. Of course, with the advent of the internet, the third and the fourth markets successfully started to court retail customers. So no longer do we have to deal with mutual funds and pension plans with hundreds of thousands. We can now deal with people, because of the technology, buying and selling 100 shares. And of course, as we saw, the NASDAQ and the New York Stock Exchange said, oh, we want to get in on this. Yikes. So here we've finally gone through the various places to buy and sell stocks. And what you'll still hear people say, and you have to be ready for this, and I want you to have a good answer. You don't have to use my answer, but I want you to have a good answer on slide 31. Isn't the stock market all just one big malignant casino, Piano? Come on. Well, the truth of the matter is the answer to this question is yes, and the answer to this question is no. Yes, it is one big malignant casino to many individuals who see the markets as just a way to roll the dice. They believe that the way to riches is to buy and sell, try to get ahead of the other guy. And as we've said in the past, we don't call these people investors. We call them speculators. We call them traders. It is very difficult, and you are up against the best in the business. And neophytes become very upset when the market turns against them. And if you've had this conversation with people who have tried it, they often become very bitter, with good reason, because it's impossible. No one has been able to do it consistently well. There are some who do it well, but even they will tell you that they run into patches where they just lose a ton of money. And the answer to this question is also no. Many others, and I hope that's what I'm going to convince you to do, will look at the capital markets as a way to participate in the growth and prosperity of the global economy. We are called investors. With a long-term orientation, investors are usually very well rewarded. So this gives me yet another opportunity to throw this wonderful quote from Benjamin Graham, who was Warren Buffett's teacher and wrote The Intelligent Investor, a book that you're eventually going to read. An investment operation is one which, upon thorough analysis, promises safety of principal and an adequate return. Operations not meeting these requirements are speculative. So, dear students, which will you be? Will you be a speculator, a trader, or will you be an investor? You have to decide. Slide 32. Oh, yeah, Piano. What about Enron? What about Global Crossing and Tyco? Excuse me. Fraud and accounting trickery and gimmicks have always been with us. They are always going to be with us. Because that's where the money is. Have you heard that saying? It's attributed to a bank robber. He didn't really say it, but it's a perfect saying. Willie Sutton, his name was. Why do you rob banks? And he didn't actually say this, but he was reported to have said, because that's where the money is. Interesting, right? Normally, but not always, folks, these firms are regulated to the nether reaches of the over-the-counter market, to the bulletin boards, to the pink sheets, now called the OTC markets. Sometimes they wind up in the NASDAQ and the New York Stock Exchange, but for every one Enron, there are hundreds, no thousands, of companies that continue to do business with integrity and honesty, usually. Going back in time, we see that fraud has been around forever. In 1973, there was an insurance company called Equity Funding, and they literally would go into a room and make up life insurance policies. Just make up people's names and put them down on life insurance policies. How did they think that was going to last? I don't know. Didn't last long. In 1986, there was a gentleman by the name of Ivan Boesky and Vagabond Inns. Vagabond Inns? Well, there are Vagabond Inns in San Diego. In fact, they're based here in San Diego. And he used Vagabond Inns as a front for his insider trading schemes with Michael Milken at Drexel, Burnham, and Lambert. If you're so inclined, do a search on Ivan Boesky. He and Michael Milken were the individuals that they modeled the gentleman, the character in Wall Street. Gordon Gekko, I think his name was, in the company, in the movie. They were the people who was modeled, because he gave this famous speech where he said, greed is good. In 2002, after the tech bubble, there was Enron, Global Crossing, Tyco, WorldCom, Adelphia. Who else? I don't remember. In 2008, it was Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, Lehman Brothers, Citigroup, WaMu, Wachovia, AIG. And don't forget Bernie! Ran a Ponzi scheme for over 15 years. How did he do it? I don't know. 10 or 20 years from now, during the next big bull market craze, someone else will take their place, folks. It comes with the territory. So slide number 33. To recap, the securities markets, the capital markets, the stock markets exist to allow investors a safe, cost-effective method to participate in the success of the global economy, and even with all the underhanded shenanigans, they have performed very well. They are changing at breakneck speed, and the change is accelerating. Whether or not we ever have one or more global 24-hour trading markets, well, that remains to be seen. But it is exciting, and for some people scary, to watch, especially for those of us who have a stake in the outcome. So think about it, folks. It's 2 a.m. in the morning, and you want to sell your 100 shares of McDonald's. You bound out of bed, run over to your I don't think it's that. You decide what you think of it. We'll see if it happens. Okay, now, go back over this. Make sure you understand these, because you need to know these. And can identify the different markets. In our next presentation, we will discuss transactions. And then finally, outline, cover the benchmark indexes that we've been discussing since the beginning of the semester. The Standard & Poor's 500, the Dow Jones Industrial Average, the NASDAQ Composite. We will discuss those in detail in our next presentation. See ya!